Hey, Big and Lazy, give me a moment of your time to talk about IECA Services, the licensed electric company operating in Kentucky. They can pull permit, they can do everything from adding outlets to your TV, installing new light fixtures, to wiring an investment property, or even building something new from scratch. So whether you're in your living room and you want to add on something to your house, or you're in a real estate investor and you want to find an electrician to rewire an investment property, hit up IECA Services right now. Link is in the bio.
Hey, this is B. Haywood, executive producer of Confirmed Multimedia. And if you want extra content, you can go to buymeacoffee.com/confirmed and get early access to all of our content.
You're listening to Confirmed.
If you're in Louisville, Kentucky, there is no reason why you shouldn't be following this podcast, man.
It shouldn't. Thank you. Thank you for the flowers, bro. Why.
This man has literally brought everyone in this city that's a mover and shaker. He's brought them up here highlighted, man. So these views, man, need to be in the hundreds of thousands, man, on YouTube, man.
Another Confirmed Multimedia production. Confirmed.
Subscribe now.
This is the Big and Lazy Podcast. Give us something good to eat. Give us something good to watch. This is the Big and Lazy Podcast. Welcome back. This is B Fines, your host, and we got Brad Harrison, the Urban Journalist. Welcome to the set.
Thanks for having me, my man. I'm glad to be up here.
Appreciate that, man. Thanks for stopping by. Somebody called our internet trophy, man. Like, and that was an honor. Like, everybody said, I just can't wait to get up here and sign it. It's just like, you know what I mean? Like, an internet trophy, and I appreciate that. Like, I guess an internet Grammy, per se, man. Welcome to the set, man.
Appreciate it, man. You've been doing your thing, man. I've been watching you and some of everybody that's a mover and shaker in the city been sitting on this couch, man. So it's only right I got my chance to sit on the couch as well.
Real talk, man. Appreciate you stopping by. And part of my podcast, like, you kind of inspired me to get into the podcast field, because I always used to watch your page and you know, you promoted positivity, you was doing good in the community, and you try to shine light to the black, you know, people, businesses and stuff like that. And I appreciate you. That's a good vibe right there, man.
Well, look, I'm glad, because that's what it was all about, man. Uh-huh. That's what it was all about. Because look, I'm like people see me and they see what I did with journalism, or they see what I did with promoting black businesses in Louisville. And look, we were doing that at a time when it wasn't cool to do it.
Ray was.
You know what
right.
I'm saying? We started this thing called Black Saturdays. It was me and it was how many, five of us? I think it was me, Tiandra Robertson, which is going on to do amazing things now. And it was me, Tiandra, who's all in that? Nene, it was like four or five of us. Uh-huh. And man, this was 2016, 2017. Yeah. And it was during a time when black people really didn't want to be associated as a black business, because it was negative back then. If you said you were a black business, people looked at it as, non-black people looked at it as being racist.
Right.
You know what I mean? Uh-huh. So, but my thing was, man, look, I came from the same environment everybody else did. Grew up, parents got divorced when I was 8, lived with a single parent, struggled, hood. By the time I was 15, I'm in the criminal justice system. That lasted until, I was 30 years old? You know what I'm saying? So I was in the street like everybody else. I was out here hustling, destroying the community like everybody else, man. And I did that. So I was about 30 years old, man. Uh-huh. And ended up going to prison.
Yeah.
And came home and decided I need to change my life. Well, let me tell you the story why I decided I was going to change my life. Yeah. My daughter, man, at the time, man, my daughter, Daisy, I don't think I've ever told this story before either. I don't even know if she knows.
Big and Lazy Exclusive.
I don't know if she knows this. But at the time, man, I had been in this. I never had a job before.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? I ain't graduated high school.
So you never had a job?
Man, I never had a job in my life.
Mm-hmm.
Never had a job. The job I'm working at, which is my own business, is my first job I've had
really?
In my life. Yeah. Well, outside of in high school, I think I worked at McDonald's or something. Yeah. I was 15 for a few months. But yeah, man, I jumped knee deep in the streets at 15 years old, and was in it, man. Like most people, I ain't gonna say most people, but like a lot of people that come
right
for them environments, you know what I mean? And yeah, man, I did that, man. So when I was around 30, 31, 32, got out of prison, did a few years, and my daughter, her name is Bredasia.
Mm-hmm.
She was, at the time, maybe she was 11, 12 years old, something like that. She was in middle school. And that was the first time I had ever been away since she was born.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as an adult, I wasn't a person that went in and out or nothing like that. Like, I had a nice run, you know what I mean? So, I went and did some time, but I have a cousin that's always in and out. He's in and out on a regular basis, man. He go do 15, come home, stay out for a year, go do 4 more. He did that his whole life, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, he was on one of them little stints where he had to go back.
Yeah.
And my daughter was there, and she looked, and she was like, she didn't know what I did.
Right.
She didn't know what I did. You know what I mean? So she looked and said, I'm glad I don't have a daddy that is out there in the street committing crimes and going back and forth to jail, right?
Right.
At that moment, whatever, you know, some things just change your life. You know what I mean? For me.
Your light switch moment.
Yeah, for me, that was it. Uh-huh. That was it, man. I was still dirty at the time. Yeah, at the time, man. Believe it or not, everything I had went in the toilet. You know what I mean? Uh-huh. Yeah, the toilet, man. And real, true story, man. I stopped what I was doing and went and got a job for the first time in my life at Applebee's, man. I went and got a job. Hey, dog, the most humiliating yet humble experience of my life, right? Because, I mean, I wasn't a multimillionaire or nothing like that, but I
had some money, yeah.
Yeah, uh-huh. I did pretty well, right? And, man, I went and got a job here at Applebee's, man, on Outer Loop, man.
Really?
But I went and got a job. Look, I'll never forget, man. It was the year. I can't remember the exact year, but it was around 2010 or whatever when the Celtics were going to the NBA championship or whatever. Uh-huh. It was that time, man. I went and got a job, man, making probably $10 an hour, man.
Oh, man.
Something like that, right?
Yeah.
So let me tell you how God works. Because God is a big part of my life, man. So So I say that. But, man, I went and got this job, man, and I'm a cook at Apple. Man, humiliated. I felt humiliated because I've never, you know what I mean?
Right.
$10 an hour, you know what I'm saying? But I was changing my life, right? So I did that, man, and I went and enrolled in school down at JCC. All I had at the time, man, was a GED.
Uh-huh.
A GED, man. Went and enrolled at JCC. They made me take an aptitude test, and I always thought I was a pretty intelligent guy, but
This is after you got out of prison?
Yeah.
Okay,
Yeah, so I went, you got to take a little aptitude test to see where you're at. I hadn't been to school, and, you know, it's been 20 years or something, whatever. I was always a pretty intelligent dude or whatever, so scored pretty high on all my tests, so I didn't have to take any prereqs, and they threw me right in classes, right? So I'm going to JCC, and I'm working at Applebee's, man.
Uh-huh.
So I'm at Applebee's. I hadn't got my first check yet. I'm on my way home, and this white guy, man, his truck broke down over there on Outer Loop. So it's like midnight, man. You know, you got to close. I done scrubbed the floor, cleaned the grill.
Yeah.
I'm stinking. I'm dirty.
Yeah.
But I pulled over, man, at midnight to help this dude get his truck out the road, right?
Uh-huh.
So I helped him push his truck out the road, and he looks at me. He said, hey, man, what you do for a living? I said, I told him my whole situation, man. I'm in prison, man. I'm trying to da-da-da. And he's like, hey, man, I own this courier company, and if you come up here Monday, I'll give you a job, right?
Right.
So I'm like, you know how people, I'm from the street, so people say things all the time. You just take it like, I'm helping him at midnight. He just said something to sound cool, you know what I mean, and whatever, right? But I took him up on it, man. I went up there Monday morning, and he gave me a job, right?
Really?
So, yeah, he gave me a job, man. So he gave me a job driving for him.
Yeah.
So at the time, he's telling me, he's like, look, man, this company I got, I'm going to take it independent, meaning that I'm going to, instead of having, I'm an employee at the time. So he had drivers driving his cars.
Yeah.
And the business was mostly medical courier.
Right.
So we're picking up labs and pharmaceuticals, and we're dropping them off at hospitals, nursing homes, and clients all across, you know, the state.
Right.
So he's telling me, like, I'm in the process of turning the company independent, meaning that I'm going to take this company, I'm going to hire contractors, and if you become a contractor, then there'll be splits. Like, if I get the jobs for you, it'll be a 50-50 split. Like, I get the job for you, and we'll split, you know, the gross 50-50, right?
Uh-huh.
So I said, all right, you know, but again, right. Whatever. You know what I mean?
Yeah, sure, bud.
But I'm going to college now anyway, so
uh-huh.
I'm doing my thing, man. I'm doing that. So maybe a month or two later, the company goes independent. And when a company goes independent, what they particularly do is, like, FedEx does it, UPS, well, I don't know if UPS does it, but FedEx does it, and they hire independent contractors,
right.
And you have to purchase these routes. And these routes are pretty expensive,
uh-huh.
You know what I'm saying? Because they're lucrative.
Yeah,
so they're pretty expensive, right?
Uh-huh.
So he pulled me to the side, and he said, man, because when I got on the job, let me go back, when I got on the job, man, I handled the job the way I handle the streets or everything else, right? So in my mind, I got to be the best driver.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I got to be the best driver.
Activated. Yeah.
Yeah, so he's calling me into the office some of the days and reaching in his pocket. And one day he gave me $100, man. Like, you know, our average driver averages 20 runs a day. Yesterday you averaged 45. You know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
And that's just how I approach everything.
Right.
Like, I want to be the best at everything I do. Plus, look, man, I'm a black man. At the time, I'm the only black person at the company. I got a criminal history. I got a background. I got to be better.
Uh-huh.
I got to be better than everybody else.
Uh-huh.
To, you know, to keep this position. That was my mindset. So I did that, man. So anyway, the company goes independent. He lists all these routes where he's selling them, you know what I mean, for a certain price, right? And he comes to me and says, hey, man, you helped me that night. You've been a good employee since you've been up here. I like you. I'm going to give you a route. You don't have to buy it. I'm going to give you.
So how much would a route cost? Like, what's the ballpark
fee? They average, man. Some smaller ones may range $5,000 to $10,000. Some lucrative ones may range $20,000 to $30,000, uh-huh, depending on, you know what I mean, on right, the number of stops on the route. So it's going by gross.
Right.
So, you know, whatever the route grosses, you know what I mean, you base that on the price of the route. So, mm-hmm, yeah, so, I mean, so he offered me. It wasn't one of the $20,000 or $30,000 routes, but it was a route that I would have had to purchase, you know what I mean? So right, I purchased that first route, man, and that led into me getting multiple routes.
Right.
You know what I mean? So I was doing that. So I started doing that, man, and at the time when I'm working for him as an employee, I'm uh-huh, working third shift, man. I'm working 8 p.m. to 8 a.m.
Yeah.
So I'm going 8 p.m. to 8 a.m. This is before I became an independent contractor.
Yeah.
So I'm working 8 p.m. to 8 a.m. I mean, 8 p.m. to 8 a.m., right? Huh? Getting off at 8 a.m., going straight to class.
Oh, damn.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Going straight to class, man. So I'm going 12 hours and straight to class.
Uh-huh.
And this is why I say, God is a big part of my life. Right? At the time, though, don't ask me how I did it. When I look back on it,
yeah,
it feels like I was on autopilot.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? So I'm going from 12 hours of work to 4 hours, but from 8 to 12, sometimes 1, at school 4 times a week. By the time you do that, come home, study, do some homework, and you're laying down.
Yeah.
That's how I go back to work, man. I did that for 4 years. So 2 years in the a year in the JCC. At the time, man, I go to JCC, I'm thinking I'm going to do something like heating and air.
Yeah.
Right, because I got this criminal right, background, so I know I can't be a lawyer or right, a doctor, right? So I got
banker or something.
Yeah, I got to choose something that, you know, the background doesn't affect. So I'm looking at that, but you got to take prereqs first.
Right.
So I'm going in, man. I'm taking my prereqs, my English, my math, and my da da da. Right. So I'm in English class, man, and with English, it's a lot of writing, a lot of essays, right? So I don't know, man. I remember when I was a kid, I wrote short stories in school, but you don't think that's really something, right? But I'm in class, I'm writing these essays, and this black lady, man, professor, she pulled me to the side one day, and she said, "My God, your writing skills are, like, remarkable. Have you ever written before?" And I'm just like, I do my research, I write, I turn the paper in. She was like, "Listen," I didn't know I wrote that well. And she was like, "Listen, you are a brilliant writer. I want to take you and put you in this program called an Ultra Program." And I'm like, "What's the Ultra Program?" She's like, "It's a pathway to go to U of L."
Uh-huh.
So it's University of Louisville Transfer or something. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's called Ultra, right? So I was like, okay. You know what I mean? Whatever, right? So she's like, "I want to put you in an Ultra program, and I want you to start looking seriously into communications and journalism."
Uh-huh.
So I'm like, all right.
Right.
So the thing with getting in the Ultra program is they partnered with U of L. You do 2 years prereqs over at JCC, and you transfer over to U of L, but you have to keep a 3.0 grade point average and some other little criteria things, right? So I go through the program, knock that out. I came out of JCC with a 3.8 or something. And I'm telling you, man, I'm on autopilot, dude. I'm
right,
12 hours. But I look back on it, I'm like, man, I don't know. You know what I mean? But
uh-huh,
I breezed through that, man. I got a couple awards at JCC. Not every semester, but almost every semester, it was either honor roll or not honor roll, they call it Dean's List in college. Dean's List or what, you know what I mean? I was doing that every semester. So 2 years go by, I transfer over to U of L, I jump into communications journalism program. So I get into communications journalism. So now, you know, I come in thinking I'm gonna do heating and air. And now I'm getting into the media and journalism field as far as my studies.
Uh-huh.
So I go to U of L, man, and I'm a journalist. I'm a communications major.
Right.
So I'm over at U of L. This is the year when Russ and all them were at
right,
U of L.
Yeah,
it's during that time.
Okay,
right?
Gotcha.
And it was another quarter. I can't, man. I'm getting older now. I'm 52 now, man. But this was 2010 through 2014.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Teddy Bridgewater was there, wasn't he?
Bridgewater was there. What was the guy? The big guy on campus at the time. Man, I can't remember his name. He was a wide receiver. I think he ended up going to Miami or something to the Dolphins. But
Devontae Parker.
He was the man on campus at the time.
He was.
He was the man of even with Russ and all them
really?
On campus. Yeah, he had the clout on the campus.
So you saying during the championship run, Devontae was the man?
Because he had that swag, man. He had the, some people are personable, and the women liked him. You know, I'm an older dude, so they all looked at me like, at the time, I'm in my late 30s, maybe early 40s, but I'm a regular dude. I got my Beats headphones on. They're like, old school, but they were all cool, man.
Yeah.
But he was the man at the time.
Okay.
The football players were more popular than the basketball players.
Okay.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
So anyway, man, I go through that run, man, and I graduate from U of L in 2014, cum laude, with like a 3.8 GPA.
Really? That's what's up, man.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
So when I say I'm a journalist, I'm actually, I have a degree in communications and journalism.
Right.
Yeah, so I have a bachelor's degree in that.
Mm-hmm.
So I go through that, man, and at the time, so let me tell you how it starts where I started doing my Urban Max magazine. Because for a while,
right.
I had an online magazine. I was doing that, right? So the online magazine is called Urban Max. Check this out. This is the time when we're going through the Trayvon Martin situation, right? So Trayvon Martin happens. I'm in class. When you at schools, what they call PWIs, predominantly white institutions, right?
Right.
Which is what they call U of L. It's not a HBCU.
Correct.
So I'm at U of L, man, and Trayvon Martin happens, right?
Uh-huh.
So when Trayvon Martin happens, the black community and the white community are at odds.
Uh-huh.
Now, U of
L. So it was like tension on campus?
Man, well, the perception.
Yeah, okay.
Because
okay.
when you're at U of L, right, or PWIs, right,
uh-huh.
say when I'm in my classes, I may be one of three black people in the class.
Really?
Yeah.
Damn.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
That's just what it is. Like,
yeah.
My bad, man. I'm getting over this cold, so my eyes.
It's all good. It's all good.
Yeah, but you may be one of three, and then the other two at that time may be black, but not American black.
Yeah.
Maybe African or maybe, you know what I mean? So,
mm-hmm.
yeah, there's not many. The ratio for white to black at these big schools is low.
Okay.
It's low. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, man. So I go through there and Trayvon Martin happens.
Yeah.
So at the time, my major is communications and mass media. My minor is African-American studies, right?
Yeah.
So I'm going through that. So the white perception on campus at the time.
Yeah.
Was that, you know, the media was pushing that image of
thug.
This hooded thug
yeah.
that, you know, that approached what Zimmerman
right.
and was
beat him up,
beat him up was a criminal, right? So the black community is looking at it from the, you know, the standpoint of the police told this guy to back off. He was just walking home from the store getting his drink and he was attacked and murdered, right?
Right.
So their perception at the time, when I say there, the white people on campus, including professors, their perception at the time was that black people were criminals and thugs, especially the ones that the younger ones that wore the hoodies and dressed hip hop or whatever, right?
Yeah.
Well, here I am, even though I'm in my late 30s, maybe early 40s, I'm dressed hip hop. I got my hoodie on. It's not over my head, but
right.
got my hoodies, my Beats on or whatever, right? And they're looking at me because they know me from school as if you're not one of those
right.
black people, right? So I kind of took offense to it,
mm-hmm.
you know what I mean? So I took offense to it, but I went on a mission.
Right.
So my mission was, I'm going to change, or at least try to change, the perception of how the world views black people. Because say for us,
mm-hmm.
a black dude with a hoodie, right, to someone not from our community can look at a black dude with a hoodie and look at a thug or a criminal, right?
Right.
But we can differentiate between a black dude with a hoodie on that's a hooper.
Right.
A black dude that you may have to watch him when you go in the store.
Right.
Or just a dude that just got on a hoodie.
Right.
You know what
I mean? Joe, yeah. Huh?
Right. But people outside our community lump it all into,
right.
into one box, man. And I didn't like that. You know what I mean? So what I did right then, I was still in school. I started an online magazine called Urban Max Media.
Yeah.
And what I did with Urban Max Media was I went around the city of Louisville and I found I found what you're doing right here.
Uh-huh.
I found black entrepreneurs, black people from our community, not just people that you couldn't touch, but black people that were relatable, that weren't in the streets, had never been in it. Some may have been in the streets, but most
right.
of them had not been in the streets ever, had went and done things the right way, right? And my focus was, when we're in the media, we're usually portrayed in the media for a crime. If you look at the news,
right.
it's a criminal or somebody going to jail or whatever.
Uh-huh.
But we have plenty of black entrepreneurs and black
right.
people that do things the right way that don't get highlighted
right.
at all, right? So my thing was, I'm going to make being right cool again.
Because
the being cool was being a thug,
right.
being a gangster, whatever. So I started portraying these dudes. Man, my first article was, rest in peace, was John Cole. It was Mr. Cole.
He was. Cole's, yeah, I remember. Yeah,
my first article. So
uh-huh.
I go over and I write an article on Cole, and I do Mr. Cole, I do Seafood Lady,
uh-huh.
and then we do this little, it's not small, but at the time it was small, right? We do this small business that wasn't really known globally yet, right?
Right.
And it was still a pop-up shop. Well, no, it was a pop-up shop, but he was doing his first restaurant, right?
Uh-huh.
At the time, it was a small guy nobody heard of named Darnell Ferguson.
Yeah.
A place called Super Chef, right?
Yeah.
So I did his article.
Uh-huh.
I wrote his article. Right? Super Chef's article. At the time, the restaurant was over on Shelbyville Road.
Okay.
He was just getting started, man. So I wrote it, and we kicked it, man, chopped it up. I went home, and I texted that morning. I said, I'm about to put the article out, right? When I put the article out, this is the first time it's ever happened. I put the article out. Within 15 to 20 minutes, my website shut down. So the title of the article was, Man Goes From Homeless to Owning Three Restaurants, because he was homeless.
I remember the article, yeah.
Yeah, uh-huh. Man, it went 50 million views in the first hour. Website shut down.
The website crashed.
Website crashed, man. Went from here to China to Germany to everywhere, right? He called me back and said, hey, man, what's going on? I'm getting phone calls. It went crazy, right? And he tell me to this day, he said, hey, Brad, man, you made me famous. But that started
uh-huh.
his ascension into the world of being a celebrity chef.
Okay.
So that article got in the hands hands of Emerald, which is the
gossip. Yeah, the bang guy.
Yeah, the main chef. From, yeah, uh-huh. Well, got in the hands of Emerald, and well, got in the hands of Rachel Ray, I think, first.
Yeah.
And got in the hands of Rachel Ray, Emerald. They snatched him up, put him on the show, and the rest is history.
That's amazing right there.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Chef, so I tell you, we kind of connected at the hip, you know what I mean? Right. But my magazine took off. Made a lot of money off that article, too, but my magazine took off, and he took off in the celebrity world. And, like, I don't look at it like I created him.
Right.
I showed the world who he was. Right. Like, he was who he was without me.
Spotlight, right.
Yeah, I gave him a spotlight, man, at the time. And that made me feel good. You know what I mean? I'm like, we're starting to change the perception of how people see us in the world. That's what I want to do.
Because I think the media plays a lot. And cause I talk to my buddy all the time. Like, I don't really watch the news because it's always something negative, man. It's always... And at the end of the day, the news is kind of a TV show. It ain't no kind of to it. It is a TV show. And they need them ratings just like, you know, the NFL. You know what I mean? Just so I try to stay away from the media, like, and I don't know, because it kind of controls the masses, you know what I'm saying? And if, like, if and they paint that image, the public is going to run with it, you know what I'm saying?
They do.
Mm-hmm.
Look, so that's what, so in the media world, right, in the media world, and when you're learning about this in school, there's a phrase in media, right, and it's called, if it bleeds, it leads.
Sure.
That's a media term.
Mm-hmm.
So like, when you're in the newsroom, that's going to be the first segment of the day.
Yeah.
If it bleeds, it leads. And the reason being is that we can, it's a double-edged sword, man. You can hate it or love it, right? But here's the deal. I can post about your podcast, right?
Right.
And it may do well. It may get 10,000 views or whatever, right? I can post Johnny got shot on 51st Street, 1 million views. You know what I mean?
Like instantly, yeah.
So it's that thing where when it comes to media, shock factor sells, right?
Right.
So here's my beef, though. Here's my beef. And you are 100% right. So media is the number one influencer when it comes to human beings, right? And you're witnessing that right now with Donald Trump.
Right.
That's why Donald Trump is trying to control the media. You see, he just fired his chief of staff because the person that was over putting out the labor reports.
Yeah.
He fired them because he didn't like the labor report. The labor reports are what they are, but he said they were false or whatever. But if you can control the media, you can control the people. So if he can put somebody in that position and say the labor reports are better now under his tutelage, then he's controlling his image and how the world views him. And that's what media does. Like, when we watch television, we listen to music, everything we consume that's media, it shapes your view of the world, and often it shapes actions.
It does.
It shapes actions, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So when I created the media company and then started doing a radio show, I wanted to, you're never gonna overcome the negative that's out there, right? But the key is balance.
It is.
Like, put balance out there, and if you're putting out, you know, some quality, positive media, then people have an alternative to go to. You ain't gonna save everybody, you know what I'm saying?
Right.
But that's just what it is, man. So
when did you start the radio show? When did you start that?
We started doing a radio show, man, I want to say 2017, maybe?
Uh-huh.
2017. Started off doing community radio, man. At the time, this nonprofit called Crescent Hill Radio, they were doing online radio.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess they saw my articles moving around and saw me in the community, and they hit me up. I'm like, look, we're doing some community radio over here, and we don't have anyone like you on our program. Can you come over and do a segment on our program?
Mm-hmm.
So I started doing that over there with them for a while. We got too black for them. That's what I like to say. You know what I'm saying? We got a little bit too black for them, and for the time.
Yeah.
Now they'd probably be like, "Hey, come on back," but they're not even in existence anymore. But we started doing that, man, and then we went over to another place called Forward Radio, and we worked with them for a while. They were another nonprofit that was into community reform, if you want to call it that, or whatever, and we did that, and then we started doing our own show, the Urban Max Radio Show, after that.
Mm-hmm.
And it was me, Tiondra Robinson, and Sean Mucker.
Okay, yeah.
And we did that, man. But yeah, so it was the same concept. Like, what I was doing with the magazine
mm-hmm.
is what I started doing on the radio. I bring people up and I interview them and I highlight
uh-huh.
certain people and put that positive or out into the community, man. And I think now, look, I look back and I laugh, man, because it got so big for a while.
It did.
Mainstream media would never cover black entrepreneurs ever.
Right.
Like WDRB, this is, you know, 2017, 2018. Now they cover them. You know what I mean?
I think it COVID, the woke
movement. Yeah. Yeah.
That was arguably, if not, I'm not to take any away from Dr. King, but I think that social justice movement was just as big as the civil rights movement back in the
60s. It was big. And what made it so large, this will make things large, man. Visuals.
Yep.
Visuals. The world saw George Floyd get suffocated on television. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Or people looked on their phones and saw this man saying, "I can't breathe," and died. You know what I mean?
I still ain't watched it to this day.
Yeah. So
I still ain't.
Images, man. Yeah. Media. So I get an example of that. And I like to tell people, like, they'll say, like, well, why? Like, people might ask things, and they'll say, like, well, I don't know. I can't think of a random person. But say someone has a, we'll use domestic violence, for example, right? Say a celebrity has a case of domestic violence. We don't see it. We hear about it, whatever, right? Some of it kind of flies by. They get back to doing their thing, and it's no big deal, right? And people say, well, why is this particular situation huge and this one's not, right? Then you go to the Ray Rice situation.
Right.
And it was huge, right? Because you saw it.
You saw it,
That's the impact of media.
You never played again in the NFL. Never
played again. Yeah. You saw it, man. So, look, I have a beef, right? So I have a beef with community. I have a beef with, not the community, with, look, man.
The culture. Yeah.
I'm glad you use that word. I use it a lot. Culture is everything, right? But we're going through a traumatic time in our culture now.
Mm-hmm.
The young black generation is violent.
It is.
It's more dangerous. Oh, man, the 90s were pretty dangerous. I mean, they were dangerous, but it was contained, I guess, to street people. It felt like in the 90s, if you weren't in the streets,
right,
it really wasn't affecting you like that. But now it just feels like it can affect you anywhere, right? And people wonder, and they throw out these different things, man, and they throw out parenting, and they throw out hip-hop culture, and they throw out music, a lot of different things, right? And all of those are true, right? But there's one thing, man, that we overlook that we gotta really understand, man. Listen, you just said George Floyd was either as impactful or more impactful than the Civil Rights era with Dr. King, right?
Correct.
I had no argument with you about that, right?
Mm-hmm.
Also, I say this. The crack era was more impactful as being detrimental to black people
than
slavery.
It was.
And let me tell you why.
I totally agree.
So when we look at where we're at now, right,
uh-huh,
you got to keep all this in perspective, dog, that we had 30-plus years of the crack era, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm 52, so I remember pre-crack. And I heard Tupac use this phrase, so I don't want to take credit for it, but one time Tupac used this phrase called BC, before crack, right? I remember before crack. And let me tell you how bad crack rocked us, man.
Uh-huh.
Not
to cut you off, but I say this all the time. Crack cocaine did wonders. Now, I say wonders, negative, you know, to the community. Like, and it took fathers away. It turned mothers, you know what I mean? Everything. And we still, like, these crack babies from the early 90s and late 80s, they are parents now. And it's going to take a while before we heal from that, but go ahead.
We on the same page.
Yeah, real talk, yeah.
So listen.
Because none of us directly was affected by slavery. Not one person on this earth was directly affected by slavery, but we know.
We can feel.
Right, yeah, feel right now.
I see what you're saying.
Yeah, but.
Indirectly, we've been affected, but yeah, I see what you're saying.
But
we've lived through.
Right.
Through this, right?
So how many people just lived with their grannies? Our mother was on drugs. Our father got hit with 30 years. But you go ahead.
Look, man, let me give you this. So around, I was born in 73.
Mm-hmm.
So I was born and raised, I was born in San Francisco, California, raised in the Bay Area. Raised San Francisco, Oakland, in a town called Fremont. Born and raised out there. The crack epidemic hit us out there first, 82,
yeah.
81, 82, 83, right? Kind of went to the rest of the country after that, right?
They say Oakland's almost like the mecca of the crack.
Yeah,
uh-huh.
Yeah, it was called the City of Dope. That was the nickname back then or whatever. But yeah, man, so the 80s, the crack epidemic, I'm what, 12 years old in 85, and it was probably the height of it there, you know what I mean? And
right.
It took over like a zombie apocalypse, you know what I'm saying? Like, it was everywhere, right? So let's go back. So you say from 85 until roughly the height, I'll say 2015 or something like that.
Uh-huh.
So you're talking about 30 plus years, right? So when you're talking about 30 plus years, you're talking about parents addicted, people addicted, children growing up in homes of addicted parents. Some children growing up on the street, some children being abused, some people being sexually abused, physically abused, or left out to be raised by themselves, right? And my generation, I was raised in the 70s, right? Mm-hmm. So I was raised in a generation where still two-parent homes, grandmother, parental love, nurturing. We grew up in a different time.
Mm-hmm.
But the crack epidemic of the 80s took all that away, right? And on top of it, you had mass incarceration, right? Yeah. So you had this going on. So you look at the stats, man, and you look at 1985, right? You say in 1985, you had roughly 640,000 people incarcerated in the U.S., right?
Yeah.
Then starts the war on drugs. So you go up to 2015, and you have 1.5 million people incarcerated, and most of them low-level drug offenders, right?
Right.
But the war on drugs began to give these huge sentences, 20, 30, 40-year sentences. Some people ended up with life sentences, right? And then if you didn't have those big sentences, you had people going in and out, addiction. So you got a whole community that's affected by crack cocaine for 30-something years, right? There's I tell people this now. Right now, we're going through an opioid and and opioid and heroin and
fentanyl
epidemic, right? You won't see the true effects of that for 25 or 30 years.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? When these people that are using it now, you see how their kids come out, how they're, you know what I mean? So that's what we're going through now. So a lot of these kids were raised during the crack era. Parents are on crack, or these are parents that grew up in that era, and now they're parents, and they don't have the skills, or they don't have the nurturing or the loving to teach these children, right? So that's another initiative. Go ahead.
Not to cut you off.
Go ahead.
The fathers was almost removed from the black household.
Yeah.
And I say that because it's a lot of women today that ain't never got a hug from their daddy. Men got daddy issues too, but it's never, that's key. A key point in a little girl's life to, I love you. Get that hug. A lot of women, they never got that hug from their daddy. But I'm going to ask you this. Describe some of the changes in the community. Like you was in the heart of it. Like, what? Describe some of the changes in the community. Like, some of the, like, you know, like, I ask this all the time, like, you know, people that grew up in the era, like, was it like, I don't know, like...
I think the change, man, I think the sentiment is starting to change, right?
Uh-huh.
Not fully where I would like it to be, but the sentiment is starting to change. So when I say that is, I go back to what I say the early 80s, right? At that time, when the drug culture first hit, or the street culture, or the gang culture, it was frowned upon.
Uh-huh.
Like, none of our parents agreed with this. All of them said, hey, stay out on the streets, come to church, or, you know, if you do this, I'm going to disown you. Like, we were, it wasn't praise, right? Then it became so normalized during the 90s, it became normal during those times. People accepted it, right? And the cool guys became the hustlers and the, you know, this and that. Now I think the sentiment is starting to change a little bit. I've seen that change, right? As people get older and they see the effects of it, right? And this is one of the things I push. And I'm not judging because, like I said, I was part of that, right?
Right.
But I say this, man. We, at the time, you know the phrase, when you know better, you do better.
Right.
At the time, man, we didn't realize how bad we were destroying the community, but we destroyed it, man.
We did.
We destroyed it. Like, if you participated in the drug game, you helped destroy your community, right? And the thing is that even if the people chose to do drugs, you were an arm in helping them destroy themselves and the community, right? And you kind of owe it to the community to help rebuild it, right? And at the time, you're thinking, when you don't know, you're ignorant. When you're in your ignorance, right?
Uh-huh.
I was in my ignorance. When you're in your ignorance, you're thinking like, man, I got a five-man crew. All of us are doing well. All of us own homes. All of us have nice cars. All of our families are in a better place, right?
Yeah.
So when you look at that, you're looking at, say, me and my children and my spouse at the time, right? Or my friends and their people, right? What is that a total of? At most, 40 people, right?
Right.
We're destroying thousands.
Really?
Thousands. Mm-hmm. And then when you come back around, you feel like, I fixed up a couple houses in the hood, gave out some backpacks, and did this and that. And I'm helping the community, right? You built five houses, but hundreds of thousands of people lost their home because they was addicted to crack and couldn't work. And, you know what I mean? So you were part of that, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then a lot of people are indirectly a part of it and don't even realize it, right?
Right.
So say this. Say you've never sold drugs in your life. You've never been in the street or whatever, right? But you have friends and associates that do, right? And you kind of put them on a pedestal. Say like in our community, a big thing is when the big drug dealer gets out of prison, he throws a party and everybody comes to the party, right?
Right.
Well, say you've never sold drugs a day in your life, right? But you come to the party, right? How can you then, you're condoning a culture that is detrimental, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I did it as well, right? But how can I then tell a young kid, stay out of the street, don't get into the game, when I was attracted to the game by money, cars, clothes, and women, right?
Right.
But now I'm not selling anymore, but the guy sitting right here next to me, he represents that, and he's my friend. And these kids, they're not dumb. They see that. So how can I tell a kid, hey, don't go do this when the cool guy sitting next to me is doing that? Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? So I kind of had to isolate myself away from people that I knew from the past that do that, right? And I don't judge them. I'm not going to tell on them or nothing. Like, you know what I'm saying? None of that. And I don't look at them in a bad way. It's just that my life is over here now, and I'm really about helping our people overcome this culture, this mentality that is actually destroying us.
Because
we fight other forces, man, to keep on destroying us. Other forces trying to destroy us as well.
Right.
And we can't keep destroying ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Hey, big and lazy, give me a moment of your time to talk about IECA Services. They're a licensed electric company operating in Kentucky. They can pull permit. They can do everything from adding outlets to your TV, installing new light fixtures, to wiring an investment property, or even building something new from scratch. So whether you're in your living room and you want to add on something to your house, or you're a real estate investor and you want to find an electrician to rewire an investment property, hit up IECA Services right now. Link is in the bio. And when I see the difference in the crack era and the opiate area, they actually getting help now. So yeah. I don't think it'd be a stronger in 20, 30 years, it'd be a stronger effect because it wasn't no treatment programs. It wasn't no, you was going to jail. You was getting 5 years for a sweet and low packet of crack. If your child got addicted to crack, some mothers was getting arrested right there on the table. They didn't even get to heal up from their baby. They was going straight to
getting arrested for a crack pipe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Look, me and the old mayor, Mayor Fisher, right? And yeah. I like Mayor Fisher, man. Me and I need to talk to him.
I've talked
to
him for
years, right? Yeah, I interviewed
him. Yeah, uh-huh.
And I consider not a friend, but he was somebody that I could talk to, I could call up, and he would respond, mm-hmm. and we had a connection, right? And then when the Breonna Taylor thing happened, and I'm going to call it like it is, right? And I felt he made some wrong moves in that situation, and I called him out for it, and we haven't spoken, since then or whatever, right? And
what'd you say the wrong moves were,
He was on the air. He was on our program, and I think it was on a video call at the time because it was COVID.
Yeah.
And I basically told him that I felt like under his tutelage, LMPD was running rogue, running amok, and that he was a failure in that position by allowing that. And why I said that was because prior to Breonna, man, it was maybe 2 months before Breonna Taylor happened, right?
Uh-huh.
There was another thing. I think it was Ahmaud Arbery. It was one of those other murders that happened that we saw on video during that time, right?
Uh-huh.
And Fisher came up and he said, listen, he said, we've seen these police shootings in other cities. And one of the biggest problems is after it happens, they're not being transparent. They're not releasing the tapes. They're not releasing the body cam videos or whatever, right?
Right.
And we want to take initiative to, if anything happens in this city, we want to be proactive and we want to be transparent, right?
Yeah. Well,
I guess if he had a crystal ball,
right,
he'd take that back, right? A few months later, Breonna Taylor happens, and they were everything but transparent. Mm-hmm. It took almost a year to get videos that were chopped up, hidden.
Right.
You know what I'm saying?
Did they ever release the video?
No, they said there's not any videos. There's like little portions of police outside the scene, but the whole entire situation was like pulling teeth to get any information about that particular case, right? And
mm-hmm.
I'm not going to say it felt like a cover-up. It was a cover-up. So I felt like he wasn't that person, but when things happened, he was that person.
Man.
And I said it. You know what I mean? So those are kind of things that you go through when you're speaking in these spaces, you know what I mean? But I never want to be a person, man, that I build relationships with people. Because some people get in these spaces, I feel like, and they're invited to certain rooms and they're excited to be in certain rooms, and then they just become a puppet of the people in the room, right? I don't want any friends that are, I don't want any political friends because it's clout. You know what I'm saying? Like, I come in here for a change.
Right.
Yeah, and if we're not talking about that, we really don't have anything to talk about. So
I remember you had an article about, it was almost like a theory that that the government was trying to seize that area.
In D.C.?
No, they were trying to seize the area off 26 off that street. And
Yeah, that wasn't my theory. That was I spoke about it.
I think you was like the first person to cover it.
I want to say that the investigators for Breonna Taylor's investigators, the attorneys, their investigators uncovered that. And what they were saying was that there was an area over there on what street is that? Is it Madison? No, it wasn't Madison. It was
right before Madison.
Elliot.
Yeah, Elliot. Yeah, uh-huh.
Elliot. So there was an area on Elliot Street in between 26th and 24th that was plans. It had plans to be gentrified to become one of the areas that Mayor Fisher was kind of toting as his pet project before he left office. And they had investors to start, I guess, working in that area. And I don't know what their plans were, but they had plans to kind of revitalize that area.
Mm-hmm.
And this particular drug trafficking group was in abandoned houses over there selling dope out of those houses. So they created this, they created this new task force, and those guys were the first target on that task force list.
Uh-huh.
So they started talking to these guys, and it was crazy, man. I started looking into it because, I mean, they were over there selling drugs, and I mean, okay, it is what it is. It was against the law, right?
Right.
But you would think from the man hours that they put on these guys that these were major kilo distributors. They weren't they weren't that. You know what I'm saying? So, they were getting a little money, but they were, weren't high-level drug dealers. And they put all these manpower and all these dollars in law enforcement to get this particular group of guys.
Yeah.
And then it became personal because they would try to get the guys and they couldn't get them the younger generation. Wow, man, they would go on social media and post up to the officers. Ha-ha, it was just practice. You thought you was getting it. Yeah, it became a taunting thing.
Yeah,
man.
Uh-huh.
And I think it kind of became personal, and these officers, man, began to violate the law and violate civil rights just to target this particular group, and it ended up in that young lady being murdered.
Oh, damn.
Yeah, so, a lot of people don't know that story,
right.
I mean? So, I mean, yeah, true, they were selling drugs, right, but then they started fabricating information, like they were,
chapel or something.
Well, there was a search warrant, LMPD, because of whatever.
My thing Go ahead.
The LMPD was not allowed to have packages searched at UPS.
Mm-hmm.
Because something happened where they weren't dealing with LMPD anymore, right?
Right.
So LMPD had, the LMPD detectives had a Shively police officer go out there and inspect the package, right?
Yeah.
But they inspected the package, and Shively police determined that there were no drugs being sent to Breonna Taylor's house. Dude, or her boyfriend ordered some shoes that went out there, right? But they told, Shively told the LMPD detectives that they were shoes, right?
Uh-huh.
They wrote up on a search warrant that it was drugs.
Whoa.
That's what led, that was one of the things that led, that's why you see the two officers being, you know, that are on trial now.
Yeah.
Because they put misinformation and forged documents on the affidavit for the search warrant, and they took it to Judge, I think her name was Judge Shaw.
Yeah.
Took it to Judge Shaw because she was a judge that was pretty much of a pass me the affidavit and I'll sign it. She wasn't reading it because, you know, when you present an affidavit, it has to have evidence to support the reasons why you want to get a search warrant. She was just a
Trouble? Because I always thought like
a judge.
Oh, okay.
So, you know, judges are voting in, right?
Uh-huh.
So she couldn't get fired or anything, but when next election came, yeah, she lost the election.
Oh, wow. That's amazing.
There's a black judge in her place now.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's what's up. We've got a black judge in there and got her out of there. Because I always thought, like, where did this information come from? Like, who signed this, you know, who signed the, where did the search warrant come from? So, okay, it all makes sense now.
Yeah.
So, do you feel that Breonna Taylor got the proper justice?
No. Nah, man, you know the history of America, man. Like, they violate these rights, and then they feel like these lawsuits, paying out these extravagant lawsuits is justice, right? And, of course, you're going to pay for taking someone's life. I mean,
right.
Part of it, right? But, man, some people need to, you know, I think one officer, the officer that did the shooting, didn't get charged at all. You know what I mean? So Brent Hankerson is charged for shooting through a window. He's basically charged for shooting inside the apartment without hitting anybody, without having proper vision of where he was shooting. And he, what'd he get? What, 3 years now? Something? A little less than 3 years? He's the only one convicted on that case.
Hmm.
You know, so.
Yeah.
And people look at it like, man, the public, it was like media. Again, like I say, with media, right?
Right.
So a lot of people outside of Louisville, Kentucky thought that the drugs were in Breonna Taylor's house. Kenneth, her boyfriend at the time, that when police came through the door without announcing themselves, he thought they were, the house was being broken into. He shot, hit one officer in the leg, they returned fire, hit Breonna Taylor, right?
Yeah.
But that wasn't even the house where the drugs were at, and he wasn't a drug dealer. So they were investigating the dudes on Elliot, right?
Yeah.
They were investigating the crew on Elliot. During the investigation, they found that he had a relationship with Breonna Taylor, right?
Mm-hmm.
They saw him go out there a few times or whatever, right? Well, the investigation was so lackadaisical that a month prior or 2 months prior, she had quit dealing with this dude. She got a new boyfriend.
Uh-huh.
So they went and kicked in the door on Elliot, arrested him for the drugs, right?
Uh-huh.
Then went to her house thinking there's money and stuff hidden out there. And she ain't even with the dude no more.
Huh.
The new boyfriend in there that ended up shooting at him, and that's how she got killed. But they forged documents on the affidavit to even, well, they put misinformation on the documents to even get the warrant to go out there. That wasn't the house they were targeting with the dude. They were on
Right.
She's way out in Shabby somewhere.
That's fucked up.
Yeah, so.
I didn't know the problem, because I try to stay away from certain neck, you know, something I want to hear about. I got to read that article. I got to, you to re-peak my interest, man. I got to.
So it'd be like, say me and you here, and I'm not, but say I'm doing something. Crooked or illegal, whatever, right? And I leave here, and they follow me up here.
Right.
And they're like, well, he's on the Big Lady podcast or whatever, right?
Uh-huh.
And somehow they come up with, they may see me pop a trunk before I came here, and like, he might have took some drugs in there or something,
right,
or whatever, right? So I'm on surveillance, right?
Uh-huh.
So then, say I'm selling drugs, and a month or two later, they end up getting information, they're kicking my door at my house, and then they also submit information that, hey, 2 months ago, we seen him take a package in Big and Leggy's podcast. They come up here 2 months later. I ain't been up here since then.
Right.
You in here doing another interview with somebody else, they kick the door in, you thinking, we being robbed, you pull your gun, and everybody didn't get killed, you know what I mean? And that was kind of the situation with Breonna Taylor.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people don't know that, but that was the situation.
Because the media tried to paint her as a drug dealer, she's a drug trafficker, and I didn't...
So I mean, at one time, her and the dude did date, right?
Right.
But it was, you know, to they call that stale evidence in the criminal justice world, right? So when you get evidence, when you're doing an investigation and you get evidence, like say they thought a package was going to her house, right? When you submit that to a judge, it has to be in a certain amount of time, or the evidence gets stale, because they want the evidence to be fresh. That hey, if you think someone is dealing drugs out of his home, you can't get the evidence now and then get a search warrant a month later, because it may be a new resident there at the time. And that's
right.
What they did with her situation. They didn't know that, for one, they thought she was in there alone because they didn't do proper surveillance.
Right.
Two, they didn't know she had a new boyfriend and he was in there.
Uh-huh.
And three, they should have been out there anyway, because you put misinformation to get this affidavit. So they did two warrants at one time.
Mm-hmm.
And the team, the main team that was downtown on Elliott, that was briefed of all the information, right? They didn't know about the second team that was going out to the house.
No shit.
No. Huh. Did not know.
Oh, so it was two different teams.
Two different teams. One team on Elliott, one team out there at our house in Shively.
Uh-huh. Oh, wow.
At the same, you know, simultaneous raids.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, yeah, that's how that happened, man. And when it all came out, the other team was like, well, we didn't even know. Like, we do briefings before we do raids. So, like, a week before, then, you know, the day of, and there's people that scouted out to make sure there's nobody. Yeah, they do all that. They're like, we had no idea about going. So I'm like, what was y'all going out there to do? If y'all thought money was out there, was this a robbery?
Right.
It sounded like it.
Right? So, yeah.
That's wild. Yeah.
So, RIP to Breonna Taylor. To switch subject a little bit. So, who was your favorite interview? Like, who was your favorite person to interview? And why?
When I was interviewing people, who was my favorite person to interview? Man, that's a hard question because there were so many over the years. I don't know, man. I enjoyed all of them. If I had to say one, and his name, he gonna kill me, man, because his name, I can't think of his name right now. I talk to him on social media almost every day, man.
I'm terrible with names, too.
Yeah, man, and I feel bad because I really know the dude, too.
Yeah.
But at the time, he was working for JCPS.
Uh-huh.
But there's two people. I'm going to give you both of them.
Yeah.
He worked for JCPS, but he also was part of, you know, remember when Muhammad Ali died?
Yeah.
He went out to the airport, whatever it was, Airport Association, Airport Board, and he pitched the idea that we should change the name of the airport to Muhammad Ali International, right? Which is what it is now, right? And I think they gave him some resistance about it or whatever, and they got all his ideas, and a year later, they ran with the plan, right? Mm-hmm. So he came on the show, and we discussed it and kind of out of the situation. That was probably a good interview, but the other one was, there's another guy, I cannot remember his name.
Oh, man.
God.
It's all good.
But let me tell you about him. Yeah, so look, he's a tailor.
Uh-huh.
He's a tailor here in Louisville, Kentucky. He makes men's suits. He's a tailor. He makes your suit from scratch, right? This was a big one, man. And here's the thing. Why I say these are important to me, because these create change. This one actually created change. And we went against, man, WDRB and the Kentucky, let me get it right, the Louisville Derby, not Churchill Downs, but it's the Louisville Derby, the ones that put on the parade and all that, Louisville Derby, I can't think of the celebration of committee, whatever it is, the committee that puts on, they create the Pegasus pins and all that, right?
Mm-hmm.
So check this out. This had to be, I don't know, man, 2018, 2019 or whatever. So for years, the Kentucky Derby, the people that wear Kentucky Derby Festival, I think is what it's called, Kentucky Derby Festival Board. So the board of like 12 people or 16 people, whatever it is. So for years, they all wear these boring, plain brown jackets and this little whatever, right?
Mm-hmm.
So they hire this black guy that is a guy that makes suits, right?
Yeah.
And they hire him to make their new jacket.
Yeah.
He makes this jacket they wear right now. It's a pink jacket, right?
Uh-huh.
So it pops. It's a pink jacket, man. It's designed well. It's cut well. It gave them some flair, right?
Uh-huh.
They wore these jackets, man, and they won awards.
Really?
Yeah. It took the derby from an old country-looking thing to a new, modern, hip-looking derby. Just these pink jackets, right? All of them wear them. The ambassadors and everything, right?
Uh-huh.
So he sold them this jacket as a one-time thing. I'm selling you these jackets as a purchase, but I own the rights. And he put that in the contract to these jackets, right?
Uh-huh.
Well, they took the jackets, and next year, remember every year we had a Pegasus pin?
Yeah.
For people that aren't from Louisville, there's Kentucky Derby festivals all around town. You have to buy this Pegasus pin for five, I think it's $8 now, but
yeah,
it's my pin that gets you into the events, right? But it's a Pegasus, like a horse Pegasus, which is, I guess, the mascot of the Derby festival or something, right? But it's a Pegasus pin. Well, this year, they took that jacket that he made, a pink jacket, and made it the Derby pin. So the Derby pin was the actual Pegasus jacket. Instead of a Pegasus, it was the jacket, the pink jacket, right?
Uh-huh.
So, mind you, these pins sell for $7 to $8 a piece, right?
Uh-huh.
So they sold, what, 500,000 pins or whatever, they sold 1,000,000 pins, right?
Yeah.
He come at them like, hey, I own that design.
I need a cut.
I just want a dollar.
Yeah.
I want a dollar off each one, right? You sold a million, I want a dollar off each one, right?
Uh-huh.
Beat it, right?
Right.
They tell him, beat it, right?
Uh-huh.
So what they do is, when you're going against, and I love going against these type of people, man. When you're going against these big corporations and machines, because they got all the money and the power, they think they can bully you, and that's what they're trying to do.
Right.
So they tried to bully him and was like, shut up. Ain't nothing happening, right? So I think he filed a lawsuit, but it wasn't getting any traction. But anyway, he he either hit me up or whatever. I found out about it. He came on the show. So we talked about it, and I posted about it, and we blew it up, man, and went viral. What pissed me off was at the time, he's back here in Louisville now. They had a president of WDRB named Bill Lamb. I'm sure everybody in Louisville knows we used to do a thing called My Point of View.
Yeah, Bill Lamb, uh-huh.
Yeah, man, I can't stand it, dog.
Really?
No, let me tell you why.
Uh-huh.
Okay, Bill Lamb does his point of view after this derby thing, right? After these pins. When my guy tries to sue, and I can't remember his name. If you're watching it, my bad, dog. Can't remember. But anyway, Bill Lamb does a whole point of view and calls him a criminal, a crook, that tried to shake down a derby festival.
What?
He's to be put in jail, blasted him, right? I was pissed. Oh, I was pissed, dog. So I said, come on, we're going on a campaign.
Uh-huh.
We're going on a campaign.
Right.
Came up to the radio show, man. We did a campaign. We pushed that on social media. It goes viral. I like to think, during this situation, because that's slander when you're calling someone a certain thing.
Yeah.
Bill Lamb lost his job for whatever reason. He left here. I don't know if he got fired or whatever. Immediately after that, he went, and he had been here for like 30 years. Then.
Right, yeah.
Arizona somewhere. He left. Lawsuit happened. They had to settle with this man, pay this man out, and he won his case.
So he got, did he get his dollar? Did he get his dollar?
He got a dollar. It's undisclosed amount.
But okay,
He got
his check. Okay.
Yeah.
That's what's up.
Yeah.
I always liked his point of views, Bill Lamb. Yeah. So he,
and
damn.
And they took that segment off of, you can scrub the internet. You can't find it. But he went on the internet, man, and called this man verbatim a thief, a criminal, a fraudster that's trying to shake down a Kentucky Derby Festival for a jacket that they paid him for. Like, this is just, and he saw him. I'm like, well, did you, I'm asking him first before we do these things. I'm not going to just put out anything. So
yeah.
I'm like, did you give them the rights?
Yeah.
To the jacket, he showed me the contract.
Right,
I retain the rights to the jacket. I'm selling you this jacket, but it's my design. And you guys made millions of dollars.
I don't want
to
cut.
He won a dollar or two, something like that. I thought that was fair.
It was. It sounds fair to me. Yeah, you know.
Yeah. So those are the kind of things that media does, man. So
have you ever received backlash from a person that you interviewed? And if so, how'd you deal with it?
No, I've never received backlash from anybody I interviewed.
Uh-huh.
Ever. One time. Let me take that back. One time, man. Uh-huh. And it was like, I don't know if it was growing pains, man, but one time. Not from the content, because we've never put out any negative content on a person ever, right? But I had a guy up here, man, early on. White dude, man, named Jeff Gill. Jeff Gill, man, he's a good dude, man. And people need to check him out. He has an organization called Hip Hop Cares.
Yeah.
And what they do is, you know where the homeless people be at?
Yeah, I know. I heard that, yeah.
Man, he comes out there, man, with food every weekend, right there on the corner, First and Broadway.
Uh-huh.
Not just that, though. I think he has like a van now, a Sprinter van.
You think he gets haircuts?
He gets haircuts, food, whatever, right?
Yeah.
And shout out to Jeff, man. I'm not getting on you, Jeff. I'm just telling the story, man.
Yeah.
But Jeff was one of our early interviews, man. And he came on, and I saw him and sought him out. He came on, man, and we did the segment at the time. This is how long ago it was. There was their Facebook Live was brand new, right? So it was new. Like, it was barely rolling out, and at the time it was kind of blotchy where you couldn't use it good or whatever. But his interview came out, and I think maybe Facebook Live may have came out that week, maybe, or whatever. But we did a recorded segment of his interview and we put it out, right?
Yeah.
And then the very next week, another guest came on and we did the recorded set. It was a recorded radio show at the time. So we did a recorded segment, but we also went live while the person was there on Facebook, right?
Uh-huh.
Man, he called me the next day, man, going off. I was like, whoa, what's up, Jeff? He felt like, because he was a white guy, we didn't go live because he was white. I'm like, Facebook Live just came out and we really didn't, it wasn't even a tool like it is now.
Yeah.
We didn't even think to use it until the next interview. It was our first time ever using it.
Right.
And he thought like, nah, it's because I'm white and you guys treated me wrong. And the next dude came up here. Y'all went live with him. Because at the time, we would record the segment. And I think it might have been posted like on SoundCloud or something. We would put it out.
Yeah.
You had to listen to it, the audio, right?
Uh-huh.
So the video did a lot more. You
right.
know what I mean? But it was our first time ever doing it. It was just a random thing that we thought to try to
right.
use it. He thought, but we ended up patching up, man. It was cool that up. But yeah, he was pissed.
Right.
God
damn.
So that's what I'm saying. When you do things sometimes, people may take what you're doing and look at it as an ill intent,
uh-huh.
and it's not, because it's just a misunderstanding. And I'm like, if people sit down and talk about things,
right.
you can get to understand it, but people can jump to conclusions, man, and blame you for things that
uh-huh.
that, you know, go the wrong way for them, I guess.
A simple conversation can, you know, prove a lot, you know, settle a lot of things, man. But yeah, like you said,
you want to fight me? I was like,
I'm too old to be fighting. I'm, I'm 35 with bad knees. I ain't got no trouble or smoke with anybody. And I just love promoting. It's out of 120 episodes, you're going to have a negative one or two. But
it happens, man.
Yeah, that's still a passing grade. That's still 99 out of 100, 98 out of 100. That's still an A+, ain't it? Yeah. So are you getting back into the...
I'm going to get back into it.
Back up.
I'm going to fire back up, man. And I keep telling my wife, man. And
congratulations on the marriage, too, man.
Thanks, man. Yeah, I've been married, I've been married 3 years now. Mm-hmm. Yeah, 3 years. So I've been a victim of my own success, so to speak, I guess.
Yeah.
So, I mean, my heart is still in helping the community, right? Because, like I said, I literally feel like I helped destroy the community. I owe it to the community to help rebuild the community. There's no ifs, ands, whether it's through positive media, if it's through highlighting businesses, or if it's helping kids, I owe it to the community, man, because I did a lot of damage out there. I was doing that for maybe 8 or 9 years. The business I was telling you about, the medical courier business or whatever, during the pandemic, man, the pandemic came, and of course, medical supplies, COVID tests, the business took off for me, man, and I dived into it head first, man, and I've been 10 toes down with that so hard for the past 5 years that I haven't got back into the community space, man, and I need to, there comes a time, man, where you need, everything shouldn't be about money, you know what I mean, and
right.
Put money to the side and go ahead and get back into it, and that's what I'm gonna do, man. I'm gonna
okay.
get back into it, yeah.
So is Big and Lazy going to be your first interview? Firing back up? Are we going to be the first?
You got that.
Uh-huh.
You got that, man.
I appreciate that.
I like what you're doing, man. I really like what you're doing. Because I feel like when we were doing it, man, it was like I said, it was something to help the community, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then I feel like as it was new, it was podcasts weren't even really a thing until COVID, like big like they are
right.
now.
Uh-huh.
And I feel like a lot of people say you might have felt like you were inspired, whatever. Mm-hmm. And you've taken what we've done, man, and times 50. You know what I'm saying? So I like to, yeah, man. So we got cameras, lighting. The studio is nice. The great microphones, you know what I mean?
Pillows and shit.
Yeah. So I'm like, for people to, that's what it's all about.
Uh-huh.
If I can change some people, then you can change some more people.
Right.
It doesn't matter who does the change to me. You know what I'm saying? As long as the change is getting done, man, a lot of positive people been highlighted through your platform, man. I'm going to say one thing before we leave, though, right? Before
we get off. We got time.
Okay.
Go ahead.
I got two passions, man. I got two passions. And black people are not going to like this. But I have two passions, right? And I think they are some of the biggest detriments to our community, right? And when we talk about culture, right, culture just becomes a way of life from normalizing things that we do. And a lot of culture we pick up, you know, we pick it up, man, and it hurts us. And one of the big parts of the culture that hurts us, man, that we are partaking in heavily is the abandonment of the nuclear family, right?
It has.
And when I say that, man, and look, let me tell you, let me be the first to tell you. I got 5 kids, right?
Mm-hmm.
My youngest now is 26. I'm an old man. Yeah. My youngest is 26, right? Uh-huh. I have 5 kids, man, and I was not married when I had my 5 kids, right? Raised them well, you know what I mean? But nonetheless, I was not married, right? But when we start talking about the nuclear family in our community, right? We are a community. We are a community that we're affected, man, by poverty. We're affected by all these things are factors from slavery and segregation. And we, like, you know, the old Monopoly thing, like the rest of the world, the white generation got a 400-year head start, and we've been free 50 years, and we trying to catch up, right? But we have developed a culture of baby mama, baby daddy, right?
I hate that term with every bone in my body.
Yeah.
I hate that.
And let me tell you how
it's so, co-parenting. I hate that too.
Let me tell you how it's so detrimental, man, is this. We actually think we can do it better. I don't need her. I don't need him or whatever, right? Well, here's the thing, man. When you start looking at, and I'm going to throw some stats out here for people, right? When you start looking at prison stats, right? Or incarceration stats, right? When you look at incarceration stats, over 50% of the people that are incarcerated come from impoverished communities. Over 50% of the people incarcerated come from single-parent homes. These are facts. These are stats. You are much more likely to enter the criminal justice system if you grow up in poverty. Double that if you grow up in poverty and from a single-parent home. Let me tell you why. If you're coming up in a single-parent home, right, the first thing that you limit is the amount of funds available for that child. If you, I tell people this all the time. If you poor, you ain't got no business having no kids. Not while you poor, right? Because the most expensive thing you're ever gonna do in life is raise a kid. It is expensive, right? So if you're already in poverty, right, the chances of you getting out of poverty by adding a kid to that is slim to none, right? So we're limiting what the chances that we give our children, right?
Right.
And then when you also look at two incomes in a household. Right? Yeah. Two incomes in a household, the child has access to better education, mm-hmm. better environment, better schools, more money.
Not the help school program.
Right. Yeah. They're living a better life, right, versus one income, right? So don't get me wrong. Divorces happen, things happen. But I'm saying if you're starting off with a kid
mm-hmm.
behind the eight ball, you're limiting, and we like to say in our community, I'll do everything for my kids. I say, yeah, everything except for getting a daddy and a mama. You know what I'm saying?
But my baby ain't going to do without a dad. But
I did it as well. So like when you know mm-hmm. better, you do better. I just wish as a community, we would look more into, like, okay, let me tell you something. I was in college, right? When I was in college, man, back in, like I said, 2011, 2012, whatever, right?
Yeah.
It was the first time I ever heard it, which is crazy. I come from like everybody else, right?
Yeah.
So I tell this story to my wife sometimes, man. I was in class, and I was one of the few black kids in the class, right? But I'm 30-something. I'm almost 40.
Right.
My kids are in high school now, right? So there were some little white girls beside me. There was a group of white kids all in the class, right? They were talking about some other girl, man. And they were talking, I don't know, I'll say Sarah. They were like, oh, Sarah's a whore. Sarah's a whore. She got pregnant by so-and-so, and she's going to have this baby. She's going to have to drop out of school and in college, right? And they were talking about this, and one girl was like, my dad would kill me if I had a baby before I finished college, got my career set, and mm-hmm. planned my life. And all these students around were talking like this, right? And yeah. It was literally the first time I ever heard anyone have that conversation. That's not a conversation in our community.
It's not.
It's not, right? So their mindset was like, having a kid before you finish college, start on your career, save some money up, buy a home was like...
Blasphemy, like, yeah.
Uh-huh. It wasn't even a thought, you know what uh-huh. I'm saying? And I'm like, we, in our culture, we do things that may hinder us out of culture, you know right. what I mean? And I did it as well. I did yeah. it as well, you know what I'm saying? So I'm not judging. I just wish that was one of the things that we improve in our community. Because think, if you're young and you're 18, 19, like I had my first kid at 19.
Uh-huh.
So you're 19 years old, right? Ooh, that kid costs money, you know what
yeah.
I'm saying?
Uh-huh.
And if you're able to get your life on track prior to that, you got more to offer that kid.
Right.
You know what I mean? So that's one of the things. My second thing is I had a debate on a panel with some white guys, man, about this or whatever, right? And it was about hip-hop, right? Culture influences people. It does. I mean, when I was growing up, Michael Jackson influenced us. So, you know, just different things. New Jack City was one of the things that influenced us or whatever. NWA was a big influence on us, right? But this is why I defend us to a certain extent. The argument is that the black community is where it's at now. When I say that, the young people committing violence or whatever because they're emulating or influenced by some of these rappers that are shooters and the drill music culture, whatever, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which is partly true, right? But here's my argument with that. Is this. It's easy for another culture or these people to blame the rapper, right?
Mm-hmm.
Guess who I blame?
The people behind the rapper. The machine.
The machine, yeah. right? So when you look at the machine,
mm-hmm.
man, a lot of people don't know, we have five major media companies that run the world.
Right.
Run the world, right? It's Disney, it's CNN, it's like five of them that own all even the smaller conglomerates, right? Mm-hmm. But even when you're talking about record labels, there's only a few big ones. You got Columbia, Universal, you got mm-hmm. a few big ones, right? All these companies are white owned at the top, from the top to the bottom, right?
Right.
They are choosing which artists to give a contract
promote.
To,
mm-hmm.
promote, and push, right?
Did you ever see that video, not to cut you off, that video with Bobby Shmurda, his audition video?
Dancing on the table.
Dancing like that was so cringe, like dancing, yeah. Shooter, all these white folks, you just acting like, but Ice Cube said something not too recently. He said the same people that own the prisons own the music.
Yeah, so if you look at that, man, and you're saying, okay, well, the only lucrative contracts these companies are giving out
mm-hmm.
is to this particular genre type of music, right?
Right.
Well, you can't blame the artists for coming up here to get a deal, because this is what they're going to sign. Right. If you come up here with a Public Enemy type of rapper or a right. conscious rapper or a Christian rapper, you ain't getting that check. You know what I'm saying? So
right.
these companies, and we can throw in, like what you were saying was, it's intentional, right?
Mm-hmm.
It could be, right?
You remember the world? Go ahead.
No, I can't prove intention, right? What I can prove is this. A train, look, if you and I are riding down the street, right?
Yeah.
And the car beside us is doing 55 miles an hour, right?
Mm-hmm.
Doing the speed limit, right? Are you looking at the car?
No.
Right. But if that car runs into the wall,
yeah.
you're looking at the car, right?
Looking at the
wreck. It's the same thing with media, with these entertainers, right? Mm-hmm. The music or the culture is train wreck. It's extravagant. It's you know, provocative. It's I'll shoot you, I'll kill you. So everybody's gonna look at it, of course, and buy it, right? The company is looking like this type of music will make us mass amount of dollars. We're gonna get paid off of this music, right? That is a morality thing. Should we get paid? But it's hurting this particular community, right? They are choosing to get paid, knowing that it's hurting this community because their community is not affected by it.
Right.
Their kids go to private school. The people that own Universal, they're never going to encounter the kids that are influenced by this type of music.
Yeah, they're not going to O-Block.
Yeah, so my argument is more with the machine versus the people making the music.
I forgot who Sexy Red is signed to, but they asked him straight up. He said, did you let your daughter listen to Sexy Red? No. Straight up. Said, no,
So they're exploiting our community.
Right. You know straight up.
They won't push, put it like this. White people listen to rap now, too, right?
Yeah.
And listen, today's time, right, in the white community, opioid use, heroin use, and fentanyl use you can argue that it mirrored the crack generation with them, right?
Yeah.
There's no white rapper talking about selling opioids and fentanyl because they're not going to allow that.
That's a good point right there.
They're not going to allow that.
Yeah, that's a good point right there.
Because their kids will be affected by that. Can you imagine the soccer moms up there going to rave? They hear something on the radio that's on 98 point whatever the station is.
Yeah.
Listen to, you know what I mean? One of their pop stations that the message is, go Paka Perp, go, you know, from a influential white artist.
Right.
Not going to happen.
Wow. That's a gem right there. It's not going to happen.
No.
And how many crack movies was it? So let me ask you this. Mm. Growing up, looking back, would you consider movies like Boys in the Hood, Menace to Society, New Jack, just to name a few, would you consider those horror movies?
Horror?
Yeah. As far as the picture they painted to the masses, you know.
Look. So again, this is another thing that age gives wisdom, right? Because
yeah.
I lived through those times, right? Looking back, I'll say they did both. Because at the time, the thinking was the portrayals of what was going on in our communities, it was bad in the 90s, man. If you're a little older, it was bad.
Yeah.
And those portrayals weren't getting out. We were just being overlooked. So I think they were going for an image of let's portray what's going out on here as art and also as just a portrayal of what's happening. And maybe this is a cry for help.
Yeah.
Also, it's still highlighting what's going on, right? In retrospect, it probably influenced a lot more to go the other direction. Like I said, I was raised in California time, right? And I'm raised in Northern California, Bay Area, right? We don't have any gangs in the Bay Area, right? It's an LA thing, no.
Uh-huh.
LA, Crips and Bloods is an LA thing, right?
Yeah.
No Crips and Bloods in Oakland. You know, uh-huh. No, none in San Francisco. When Colors came out, I think it captivated the world, too. Man, look, when I finally moved out here in 96, right?
Yeah.
It amazed me that a L.A. gang was in Kentucky.
Really?
It traveled the world.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I mean, in pretty much in the South.
Mm-hmm.
Every city in the South had Crips and Bloods.
Yeah.
And I think Colors had a lot to do with that, in addition to the Crips and Bloods.
I never seen Colors. I got to check it out.
The Crips and Bloods getting into the gang, the drug trade, traveling to other cities and bringing that with them. But yeah, Colors, man, it was the first portrayal of Crips and Bloods on television, and it just took the world by storm.
Who's all in that movie? Is it
Ice-T?
Ice-T?
Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to check it out. Ice-T, I haven't seen that. Is Lawrence Fishburne in it?
No, he's not in that. The cop is, what's the white guy that, I can't think of his name. Johnny Depp?
Yeah, Johnny Depp.
Yeah.
Oh, okay, I got to check it out. But before we get out of here, I asked this question, but I guess you misunderstood it. But like, growing up in Oakland, like, when did you notice the crack hit? Like, when was the, like...
For me?
Yeah, when it was 85. Like... 85? And like, what was it like?
Look, the first time that I knew, I'm 12 then, right?
Yeah.
We were walking down the street, and literally, I don't know, it was 40-something years ago, but I guess a crackhead or whatever, they used to call it Hop out there at the time. It was called Hop when it came out, right?
Yeah.
Dude was walking down the street, jumping up and down. It was just some odd, you know, for a 12-year-old, we were looking like, we knew immediately, we didn't know what type of drug it was, but it was a drug addict. We knew it was a drug addict, and then within... From 85, when I was 12 years old, that year, it just seemed like everywhere you looked, it was like Nation of the Zombies, you know what I mean, in the street. Yeah, just drug addicts everywhere. Yeah, and at the time, you had the rise of Too Short, and you know, you heard all that in the music then, but yeah, it was everywhere.
I didn't watch probably every documentary on drugs, opiates, and shit like that just fascinates me. But It was an amazing conversation, man. We can go on for another hour, man. But it was you definitely got to come back, man.
I'll be back.
And I'm going to hold you to your feet to the fire, man. I won't be the first interview when you fire back up, man. I want you. Uh-huh.
I got you.
But thanks for stopping by. It was all love. You want to shout your socials out?
Yep. Mm-hmm. I'm just on all my on Facebook, I'm Brad Harrison. On Instagram, it's Journalist Brad.
Mm-hmm.
And Journalist Brad on X, which is formerly known as Twitter.
Yeah.
And that's about it. Man, you know, I'm going to tell you, you need to get up here, man. You need to get my ex-co-host, Tiondra Robinson, up here, man.
Yes, definitely. Did you set that up for us?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You need to get up here, man. She's doing amazing things in the community. She has, like, 502 Black Business Week.
Yeah, I've seen that, yeah. Uh-huh.
She does a lot of good stuff, so y'all need to get her up here.
That's amazing. We're going to do it. BigandLazy.com is the site. Big and Lazy Pod is the IG. That's the main way to communicate me. Big and Lazy Pod at Gmail is the email. But Big and Lazy, it's our website. We got merch. We got a subscription service. We got everything. All our links is on there. We love y'all. We love the support. And we out.
Look, let me say this before you go. If you're in Louisville, Kentucky, there is no reason why you shouldn't be following this podcast, man.
It shouldn't. Thank you, bro. Thank you for the flowers, bro.
Why. This man has literally brought everyone in the city that's a mover and shaker. He's brought them up here and highlighted, man. So these views, man, need to be in the hundreds of thousands, man, on YouTube, man. So if you haven't been checking them out, check them out, man. Appreciate you, bro.
Appreciate that. Thank you.
Another confirmed multimedia production. Confirmed.
Subscribe now.
This is the Big and Lazy Podcast. Give us something good to eat. Give us something good to watch.
Hey, this is B. Haywood, executive producer of Confirm Multimedia. And if you want extra content, you can go to buymeacoffee.com/confirm and get early access to all of our content.
You're listening to Confirm.